I remember when I was a little girl, and my mom and I would be folding clothes together, as mothers and daughters do, and I'd say, "Mom, what was it like when you were a little girl? Tell me what it was like." And she would say things like, well, and I remember this like yesterday, well, my growing up years were different, a little different than yours. My mom died when I was 3, which, you know, was sad. But she said, I had a governess that raised me, and I had sort of a Sound of Music type life, and I lived in a big house. And then she'd get sort of vague about the details, and I thought, oh, tell me more. I'd say, tell me more. And she, you know, she didn't share a whole lot. I mean, who would share these kinds of things with their little girl? I knew I didn't have any grandparents on my mother's side of the family. I didn't have any aunts and uncles, but that was sort of normal for me. You know, you have one set of grandparents. And I, you know, I didn't really understand the significance of that. I do remember when I was a little girl, at some point we went to West Texas, and she shared at a church, my aunt and uncle's church, about her story. And I remember hearing that she'd been in a concentration camp and a labor camp. And I thought, well, what is that? I didn't understand what that meant, but I knew that she'd had sort of something that happened. But what I did know about my mom is that she instilled in me an incredibly strong sense of what was right and wrong. Most of all, I remember when I was a child that my mom said that it was wrong to pick on someone just because they were different. And we couldn't leave someone out. So I was very different in that way because of what she had gone through. It may have been in high school before I recognized that my mom had gone through something really big. In fact, the way she grew up was really different than the way my friends' moms grew up. I heard bits and pieces of her story. Again, not a whole lot. She'd talk about it very occasionally, not often. Mostly what she would say to me are things like, when you get married, I want you to have roses at your wedding, because my dad always promised that I would have roses at my wedding. In fact, he called me his little rose. But it wasn't until I was married and I was with Richard, my husband, at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. We had a couple of kids by then. And it was my first time to walk through the Holocaust. I'd studied it, read a little bit about it, not extensively. But there for the first time, I heard the taped testimonies, and some of you may have been there, of survivors. And I, you know, couldn't believe it. Because the things that they said on those tapes were exactly the same kinds of things that my mother had talked about. I remember hearing the testimonies, and they talked about things like how they were, and I remember her telling me how she was stripped of her clothes as a teenage girl and marched in front of the German guards and sprayed with water and DDT. I remember feeling very sick and having a hard time holding back the tears. It's kind of then that I begin to understand. The suffering that my mom endured has borne incredibly tremendous fruit in my life. Her moral convictions, her faith in God, and her love for people, particularly children, have absolutely shaped me. She's often told me, as I was growing up, that I needed to count my blessings if I ever was complaining. And she regularly talked about how fortunate we were to live in a free country. When Richard and I had the chance a few years ago to make a trip to Russia, we had the unique privilege of eating dinner with the head of the Russian Baptist denomination. Apparently, this gentleman knew my mom, because when I was introduced as, this is Alexander's daughter. And then he said, we've heard about your mom. We know what she went through as a child, and we know about the work she's doing now. And when you go home, please give her a low bow. Well, for the last 17 years, while I was raising my children, moved away from home, and we were living here in Texarkana, my folks started a new beginning, and they have gotten involved in working with the orphans out of Russia, Penza, Russia. So for the last many years, they've worked tirelessly to help these kids find families and the medical attention that they need. Some of these stories have been difficult, but at 84 and 86, they continue to be involved in many of these now young adult lives. A young girl who was the same age as Anne Frank when she went through the war and lost her entire family at the age of 14 now has over 250 to 300 grandchildren who call her Babu. Now that is the grace of God, right? With 30 years of hindsight, I can now see the significance of the verse out of Genesis that says, you planned to harm me, but God planned it for good. He planned to do what is now being done. He wanted to save many lives. Her suffering from those many years ago continues to fuel her passion to share Christ and reach out to people that are hurting. It is my privilege tonight to introduce you to my mom, Alexandra. Thank you so much that you all honor the Lord Jesus Christ for being here. He's one, the only one, who I'm standing before you. I really shouldn't have been here. From human standpoint, I should have been just like those people that you saw in the pictures earlier. But for some reason, my dearest Savior redeemed me, pulled me out of that, and put me up on my feet so that I can get strong and be able to stand like I'm standing here to witness to how great He is. I'll take you back to the year of 1800. If you'll remember, there was a Bolshevism that started in Russia. It was a terrible time, but there was a lot of unfairness going on in that country at that time. My parents came, they were all born in St. Petersburg, which was later called Leningrad under Stalin's regime. They had a wonderful life. They were blessed in the sense that they had a great job. My family were involved in a higher position there, and so the benefits were great. But there was a lot of hardship in Russia at that time. There were a lot of unfairness, a lot of trouble, a lot of discontentment, a lot of pain. And because of that, the success of Lenin was very good for him. He was able to take over the government. And so what happened to the people like my family and others? They were moved out of the Russia with the idea they're going to come back because they love their country. So my parents ended up in Yugoslavia. Many Russians, and they established a kind of a community there. They brought all the traditions with them. And so I grew up in a very much of the Russian kind of environment in Yugoslavia. My first language was Russian. I went to Russian church. And later went to private school for girls. That was a tradition for the girls to go to learn how to be young lady, refined in every area except having any common sense. My brother was assigned to go to the military school for the boys. I had a twin brother and I had one older brother. We were very blessed. I was blessed to live in a wonderful family. Even though Mom died when I was 3, and I don't remember her, we had a governess, and I had a godmother, which played a very important part in my life. And we had everything anyone could ever have. I had someone that waited on me hand and foot, which was not really, in the long run, good thing, but you don't think about it when you're a kid. Took advantage of it. We had a wonderful time because I remember having big events in our home. There were like a big ballroom and ladies would come all dressed in their finest evening gowns, and men usually were all in the uniform. They always talked about going back to Russia and live the life that they lived before. Lots of good things were happening at that time. My dad loved the music. He was great at playing a piano and violin, and I remember him playing piano with my mom's picture on the piano. He would always say he's playing it to her because he never remarried. And the things that I heard about my mom was strictly through dad's memories, all the things he told me. The things that I learned about Russia,
about their life there was strictly for my dad. One thing that he did instill in me, and that is to trust God and know that He's always there. In fact, to the extent that I would always look up to see if He's watching me, to make sure that I don't do something wrong because He can see me, because it's wrong. You'll be punished one way or the other. I didn't know what the punishment was going to be, but nevertheless, I was very cautious about it. That was not bad in itself. It was a good thing for me, because at some point when I went to school, and the last time that I saw my dad, I remembered those words very well. And I knew, though, also that my dad loved me very much. As Vicky pointed out, I do remember one of the things that we had a beautiful garden, and Dad loved the roses and grew roses, beautiful roses in the garden. And he'll say, all of those roses are going to be at your wedding someday. And there were just a real good times that I remember as a child, but they were all very short times, though. It was not that long. Because when I went to school, that was the last time I saw my dad. And of course, Germany, you know, that's when the Germans began to get very aggressive in taking over different territories, the environment in the nation was pretty bad. People were not very happy in certain regions like Austria, for instance. There was a lot of need for work, and Hitler took advantage of all of that, and he promised a better life. The changes will come about. Like, listen very carefully. Those were the words that were very strong, and the people in need listened very carefully, and they opened, with their open arms, they received him to go there. What did he do? He accomplished everything that he wanted to accomplish, because people have listened to him. One of the things he wanted to do away with the Jewish race. We know that. But the concentration camps began to open up. And nobody cared about it. If they heard anything, they didn't do anything about it. Many people that ended up in the concentration camps were not only Jewish people. Majority were Jewish people, but there were many gypsies from Romania. There were a lot of people from Bulgaria, from other Baltic states. There were Russian people like myself. And there were some even German people that opposed his regime. They ended up in the concentration camps. So one day when the Germans occupied the Yugoslavia, they took over the school facility that I was in. And I was just a little kid, waiting for my dad to come and get me. And they sent all the children home, but those that did not have a home, like in my case, it was bombed. So there was leveled. Whatever was there was gone into a dust. Was nothing there. So they sent me to the orphanage in Belgrade, where there were other children as well. In the orphanage, life was different from the children that grew up in a home in a loving family ended up in living in a situation with no families. But we had a wonderful mom that cared about us. And she was forever available to make us feel loved and protected. And she would go around trying to get some help to raise the support, to take care of us. The nuns, because the monasteries were closed, the nuns came to do the care for all of us. It was a different life. It was difficult. But I kept waiting for my dad to come and get me. I found out my older brother was killed. He was drafted into a Tito army at that time. You know, Tito was very aggressive in Yugoslavia at that time politically. And he took a lot of young men into his service. And then my twin brother and all of the people in the home were all killed at the time when the bombing occurred. So there was nothing there. So I kept waiting for my dad. In the orphanage, children always want to have their loved ones to come and get them. They're waiting. So I waited. The bombing occurred all the time, and we would go and help dig out those buried in the homes that they had been caught up through the bombs. Just day after day, we did go to school, but we had a responsibility to help. There was a German headquarters kind of behind us, and they had trenches. Whenever the planes would come flying, they knew the planes were coming, so they would go into those places to hide. And interesting, they were nice to us. They would invite us to go there as well. So we never thought of Germans as being bad at that time. Until one day, they came during the night. They got us all out of beds. They took all of us on the big trucks and then onto the train station. And at that point, they opened the cattle cars, which is big doors opened up, and it was just full of people in a standing room only. There was no place to sit down or anything. And we were shoved into that place, not knowing where we're going and why they're doing that to us. And those were the Germans that I thought were our friends, but they were not any longer our friends. The place was filled with many, many people, lots of men, women, children, young and old. Nobody knew what was happening. Nobody knew where we were going. And then they separated us from our mom that took care of us and that little bitty children. They were taken to a different place. Later on, we found out they were all taken to the Berlin and from Berlin into Russia, north in Siberia, and they were all killed there. I didn't know that till much later. The train went on and on periodically. A couple of two times would stop, and they would open the doors, and they would throw the rotten potatoes on the ground, and people would go try to grab something to put in their mouth, and they would yell, "You pigs, just like you are. You're just nothing but the pigs. Swine, swine." They would scream at people. It was terrible. And then the train came to a place that was totally unfamiliar to us. We didn't know what it was. It was covered. I mean, there was a fence all around, and there were people standing up against the fence in a striped pajamas, like. And they were in terrible condition, terrible looking, dirty, hungry, beaten. It was awful. We didn't know what it was, where we were, and they took us in, and they took all of our anything that we had on us, any book or paper or whatever we had with us. They shaved our heads. They stripped our clothes. They took us all in a big room that had soldiers all around in the room. Naked, we were staying there for some reason. They turned the cold water on us. And then they sprayed us with a DDT powder for the lice, I guess, and whatever. Then they pointed us to the corner where there were clothes laying of those that have died. They were clothes, and we had to put whatever that we could, those pajamas on and the old shoes. And they pointed us to the barracks, which had they were not the beds like we think of beds, but they were kind of a shelves-like wooden things, and you had to find a place to crawl in there. The life obviously changed very drastically. Now, take you back to an orphanage. I failed to tell you one point, how I found out my dad was not coming to get me. Where the orphans would always play a game whenever the gate would open, that it was my visitor, that whoever it is has come to see me. And we always wanted to have somebody to come and see you, somebody to come claim you as being very special to that person. And it was my turn, and it was a young man, well, I guess in his early 30s, maybe mid-30s, that walked in actually in a German uniform. And he came inside and he asked the nun if showed her a picture, if they have a little girl by in the orphanage. And she said, yes, we do. We have her. He said, can I see her? And it happened to be that he served under my father, who was involved at that time with the Vlasov's army. And he was a general at that time, and he was one under working under my dad. And dad gave him my picture, a picture of me, and he said, you might, if you survive the battle. They went back to Russia, actually, to fight the Bolsheviks. And he said, go look for my daughter. Go look, find her. Tell her dad loves her very much. And of course, he told me the dad was killed. And so I knew then my dad wasn't coming to get me any longer. So ending up in a concentration camp at that point was just another step in the direction, of course, that I did not anticipate as a kid. You know, you don't know what's the next thing coming up. But I found out later it was Dachau. It was near Munich where we were, and we had to do terrible work. Like the wooden wheelbarrows that we had to haul off people that were half dead children and put them in there and dump them into the big trenches. And one person could not push that wheelbarrow. There were two or three of us having to push that. And then others would spray the bodies with acid. We had to go and clean the latrines, the wooden latrines from the back portion of it, where we had to open it up the side and scoop it up, all that with our hands. The ammonia smelled, if you ever come anything close to something like that, it's just enough to choke you to death. I really remember much of any kind of food we didn't eat. If we got anything, it was just a tin cup of soup, maybe. But basically, you were starving to death, work and starve to death. Then after we were there, not terribly long, maybe 3 or 4 months only, fortunately, if I had stayed there, I wouldn't have been alive, because most people didn't survive after a while there. But they moved several of us up north to Island Rügen, which was a labor camp. And we worked very hard in that camp. We worked on the railroads. We had to lay the tracks. We had to dig the trenches. And this is not as strong girls having to do this kind of thing. There were no boys, there were women. But what they did, they also did a lot of experiments. They injected us with all kinds of stuff. And I know there were times when my body was totally covered with boils after the shots. Another day they took several of us and tied us to the chair and took our tonsils out without any anesthesia. They abused the older girls, something terrible, to the extent when they would come into the barracks, back into the barracks, most of them would hang themselves, or if they found a piece of metal, they would cut their wrists and bleed to death. The labor that we had to make bricks and build the houses for whoever it is, I don't know, but you were never allowed to pick up the potato or anything off the ground if you were working in a field, or else you will be shot. And many of the girls were shot right there on the spot. Once a day they would come around with a truck, would give us a tin cup of either a pea soup or with a weevils floating all on top, or a diluted potato soup that must have been potato at one time. never anything else, maybe a half a cup of coffee or what have you. It was like that day after day, the very heavy labor. We had to get up real early in the morning, like 4 or 5 o'clock, and stand outside waiting for the assignments. It was very, very difficult and very frightening, because at nighttime we had the biggest rats I've ever thought they existed would come into the barracks, and there would many dead bodies they would chew on, and sometimes they would bite the ear or whatever of a sleeping person. It was just a terrible, terrible time. The time when you begin to question, in a dangerous moment in your life when you begin to question if God really existed. If He did exist, why did He allow this? Why all of this? And so my heart was beginning to just turn totally toward hatred, toward the humanity, toward people. I loved the people that were with me, but I did not love what was happening around me, so I began to be very bitter and angry. It was just impossible to open your eyes in the morning, you know what was coming up. And so I contemplated to commit suicide, just like so many did. But I was, on one sense, I knew it was wrong. On the other sense, I didn't have courage enough. What if I survive? Even if I try to hang myself, what if I cut myself and I didn't die? What will happen then, even worse than what it is now? So I thought, okay, then God, you know, if you exist, if you love me, you will remove me out of this situation by taking my life yourself. You will allow me to die tonight. So I begged him. I began to plead with him to take my life, that I didn't want to live any longer. I could not tolerate being so angry and so hate everything, and more than anything else, questioning if God's existence. But you know, I pleaded with him. I crawled up on my bunk that had nothing but the straw, no mattress, no blanket. It was very cold. And I just cried myself to sleep, thinking God will hear me. He will take my life. I won't have to work tomorrow. I won't have to get up. But when the whistle blew and I had to jump up and jump off of that second bunk down and go stand outside, I realized there was some change in me. For some reason, I felt like there was someone that loved me that was there around me. And I also felt that there was a hope. And I was not anxious to die. I was anxious to live and help others. What happened, I think, during my prayer time with the Lord, He said, okay, I will change your heart. I'll give you a new heart. And that's what He did. He actually totally changed me. And it was the most incredible miracle that I came out meeting the girls outside and shouting to them, listen, let me tell you something. We're all going to make it. We're all going to be okay. And they thought I had lost my mind, that there's no way that I could speak like that and be so sure that we're going to be okay. So they looked at me very strangely, and partly ignoring me, partly shocked, and I said, no, trust me, we're all going to be okay. So the environment did not change. We still had to do what we had to do. We still had to work like we did. But you know, about a month or so later, we noticed that the Germans were not as abundant in the camp. In fact, it was beginning to thin out pretty down to the very few walking around, and the guards. And so I said to the girls, there were 10 of us, I said, why don't we try to get out of the camp? The only way to get out was either get on a train or by boat or by car. Well, we were very familiar with the train station, because we worked there on a railroad and we knew there were trains there. So I said, why don't we just try at nighttime and just crawl over there to the gate and see if we can get out. It probably sounded pretty stupid to think of such a thing. But you know what? In my heart, I just knew that was what we should do. And so we decided to take a chance. So we got down to the, on down on my belly, crawled up to the gate, and guess what? The gate was open. The guard was standing there with a dog. Neither one of them moved. Now, you know, that's probably people say, nah, I can't, I don't believe that. I can't imagine. And it's true. It's very difficult to believe because German Shepherd, the German soldier with a German Shepherd is death. You don't do that. But you know what? God was merciful. God made the way for us. We came out of that and we ran to the train and crawled up inside the cattle car, just like the one that we came in. And we hid inside. It was empty. And we hid in a corner and we just sat there. And then early in the morning, the train began to move. And we knew it was going somewhere off of the island. It had to be. And so we just sat in there and we'd look through the cracks of the walls and see the devastation of the war and see a lot of soldiers walking around wounded. It was very interesting to think what in the world is happening around us. And then after a while, after the day and a half, almost into the second day, the train stopped in a forest. Was a big forest in front of us. And one of the girls decided to stick her head out to see how big the train was, how long it was, because it was nighttime when we got in, and so we didn't know how long the train. And she pulled back and she said, you won't believe it. The hundreds of German soldiers are pouring out of the train into the forest. The train was long and full of German soldiers. And one of the young men saw her and thought that she was the only one on it. And he waved to her and urged her to jump, get, you're going to be killed, jump. And of course you would not want to run after your German soldiers, you want to run away from them. But he was so convincing that we all decided we will jump and run into the forest as well. Very short time after we got into the forest, the whole train exploded. So what was, the Germans were running because from what we found out later, the Russians were advancing and that camp was taken over by the Russians. Fortunately, we were able to get out of there because had we been there, it would have been another story of probably different situation. They found out who we were because we were Russians that they did not approve of. And so we hid inside the forest and we ran inside the forest behind the soldiers. They were running and we were running. And there were a lot of planes flying overhead. Those were, we found later, were British planes because it was a British occupational area, Lübeck, and they were flying over and watching those Germans running, so they were trying to keep them from hiding. But anyway, in the morning, maybe some of them were killed, but I did not worry about that. I just know that some of us were hit by shrapnels and we were running as fast as we could and hiding under the bushes and trees. And in the morning, they flushed us all out of the, they just surrounded that forest and they pulled everyone out of there into a big corral, including us with them, with our arms up. We came out of there. And they rounded us up, and then they realized we were prisoners. So they took one of the soldiers, which was British, to the apartment building, and knocked on the door, and the door opened, and it was an elderly lady about my age today. That she grabbed the lacy tablecloth off of her dining room table and wrapped around her shoulders. She was gray hair, shivering, scared. Of course, we didn't understand his language, but the motion, what he was telling her, basically, to leave the apartment and we would move in. And we waved our head, no, we can't do that. So he said, on the street then. So it wasn't safe on the street, but we had to find a place to go and hide. So we went into the bunkers, which is the basements where the Germans used to go during the bombing raid. So in the basement, we went, and the Red Cross came around and with the soup and the bread once a day to feed us. And we were not the only ones there. There were many, many people there on the concrete floor. We stayed there. We stayed there for quite some time until one of the girls died. She became very ill. And one day we saw at the height of the windows were on the street level, so I could see the legs passing by that were of the Yugoslavian soldier because I recognized the uniform and the language. And I ran upstairs to the street level to tell them we were there in the basement. They took us to their camp, which was prison camp that was liberated. They were excited to give us some food. And that's where I was introduced to American Red Cross package. And in that Red Cross package, there was a Spam. There was coffee, instant coffee. There was peanut butter, which I've never seen, and I took a spoonful of it, nearly choked to death. It was very a stark introduction to the peanut butter. So, but we were so hungry. I think we could have eaten anything and anything. I mean, when we found a piece of whatever it was thrown away by somebody, chewed it down to nothing, we would chew on it. We were so hungry. I weighed probably about 60 pounds at that time, maybe 50, 60 pounds. We were very skeleton-looking people. We stayed there for a while until the war was settling down after war, you know, and they set up the displaced person camps. You probably have read in the history that the Germany, they had an American zone and they had a British zone and they had a Russian zone. They divided in three zones. And so the prison camps that were once used for the purpose of prison, war prisoners were converted to what they call displaced person camps for the people like myself that had no country to go to. I had no family. I became stateless and many others. So they had to house somehow people like that and ration the food. I had tuberculosis, I had a duodenum ulcer. It's a miracle. Many survived after that anyway, but they tried very hard to treat us as best as they could. In fact, I stayed in the hospital for a while where they were able to treat me and feed me a little bit better than I would if I stayed in a camp. Life was settling in. They began to get organized. And, of course, the communism always is looking for a way to take over. And that particular camp in Lübeck, where I was run by the communists. And they wanted to control it. But, nevertheless, you lived there. You went. They had classes. They had schools set up. And they tried to make it as normal as possible. One day, there was a young man, well, in his mid-30s, I guess, I don't know, about approximate age, I would say, yeah. He came to organize the scouting, and he was Russian, white Russian, that is, of the bourgeois background like my family. And he looked at me, and he said, "I can't believe I found you. That was my godbrother." He had a picture, one of those pictures in the booklet. It's the one that he had, that his mom gave him and told him, be sure and look. You may find her somewhere. And so he said, I'm married. I lived in American Zone. Come and live with us. You can be with us now. You'll have a family. But when I went to ask the authorities to let me go, they literally threw me down the stairs, said, you're not going anywhere. You're going to stay right here. So he had to leave. But you know what? From the day that I found my Lord in that concentration camp in Alan Rugen, when my Jesus Savior, God, merciful God, came to me and said, I will give you a new heart. He never left me. He always, always saw to it that I meet someone that cared about me. There was always the heart of the Jesus' heart somewhere that would reach out to me. And there were people that knew that I wanted to go to that American Zone to be with my godbrother and his wife. So they put me in a mail bag one day and transferred me from one zone of the British Zone to American Zone. And that's how I came over there to that Mühlenhof, to this place, person camp. And his wife, Katja, met me at the train station. But unfortunately, her husband was in a hospital and he never came out of it alive. We got him after he died. So we had to bury him. But you know, God never, never abandoned me. Never. He never abandoned me before. He never abandoned me even when I thought he had left me. But he didn't. And you know what my dad said? You know, he's there always. He's watching you. He definitely was. I'm sure he heard as much of worse than I did whenever I suffered, because he knew I suffered. He saw to it that I am not alone, that there was someone that always cared for me. And the people in this place, person camp, where I lived in Mühlenhof, they had lots of little children, and I loved little kids. I wanted to help moms with the babies and the little children, wherever there was I was in a scouting organization, so we were always babysitting and feeding children, playing with children. And one of the things that I really loved for a long time, I wanted to be a nun, actually. And I think I was so driven to the point that I wanted to go and sit at the foot of the cross and just worship my Lord. Because I was so drawn to thank him so much for being there for me at all times, by bringing people that really cared about me. And so I met, while I was in the camp, I was assigned to go to Casablanca, Morocco. Can you imagine that? A young girl going to Muslim territory, which would have been very difficult to survive. God made different plan for me. He introduced me to a family that had some relatives in the United States. And so they came to the United States and they asked if someone could sponsor me to come here as a student. And so there was a family in New Jersey by name Korf family. They were lumber. They owned the lumber business. And then a Selsky family. They were a Russian background just like my family. Where they came and immigrated to United States, though, not Yugoslavia. And so they offered to bring me to United States. So I came to United States and came on a ship called Marine Swallow. Well, it was a really interesting experience of having to go to Frankfurt to get me a passport and had to stand because there was no room on a train to sit down. And then when I came to the passport office and stood in the line long time, and it was like 10 o'clock, I got there about 6 o'clock in the morning and stood for 4 hours in front of, in the line. And when the 10 o'clock came, I was at the window where I was to get my passport, and they just put up their signs and say, coffee break. So that's the introduction to American way of running. Had to wait till the coffee break was over to get my passport and then go back to the displaced person camp. And then a day came when I was to go to Bremerhaven, which was the place where I boarded a ship to come to the United States. I had one dress that I would wash periodically, and when I would wash it, I would wring it out real well and then lay it on a mattress and sleep on it during the night just to take the moisture out of it to wear it the next day. We didn't have any clothes. There were many, many situations to where the girls, of course, liked to look nice. And there were, unfortunately, individuals that would come and throw the temptation into the path of the girl and say, if you do such a thing, I can provide you with all kinds of pretty clothes. But I remember my dad's words. God sees everything that is right, that is good, or that is bad. Don't do anything to disappoint him. Some girls fell for it. Some were strong enough not to. So I had one dress. Everything else was made by hand out of a piece of cloth. All the underwear. You had a pair of shoes that had a wooden soles, but at least you were not barefooted. I had one little cardboard suitcase full of books, no clothes. I got on the ship, and I couldn't wait for the rope to be untied from the side. I was so afraid that that rope is not going to come off and the ship will not leave the dock. So we went on into the water and took off down the sea and into the toward the new land that I've heard about, America. You know, there was on the ship, there was a young lady that was waiting for a young man to meet her in Halifax, Canada. Someone that committed himself to her and promised he will meet her there. And she was very fancy, beautiful girl, beautiful clothes that he had provided for her for the services provided. And she asked me to go down to the occasion they were having a celebration to choose the Miss Marine Swallow for the evening. Oh, it was just a fun time. And I said, I can't go. I just have that one dress that I have on, this cotton dress. There's no place for me there. She said, I'll dress you up. Please do it. We wore the same size. She said, that would just make me feel so good if you would do that. And so, okay. She got me dressed up, fixed up, and we went down. And lo and behold, I was chosen as Miss Swallow. I guess it was, she was so excited that she had a part in it. So I guess the clothes do make a difference sometimes. Anyway, sadly though, when we got to Halifax, the young man was not there. So she had to go back. So the promises were worthless. When we got to New York, I was met by the family, that core family, and that was where, again, I was introduced to America, was the Coke and the hot dog. What was so amazing to me that the family were so gracious, they took me into their home, and she opened her closet. And she said, you know what? We're same size. Oh, I was not same size as her. I was much smaller and much thinner. In fact, very thin. But it was a compliment. But nevertheless, probably the height was the same. She said, pick out anything and anything you see here you can have. I remember going to a 5 and 10 cent store. Do you remember we used to have 5 and 10 cent store? I thought I was a Neiman Marcus. I mean, I've never seen so many things that you can buy for a very small amount of money. I lived in New Jersey for a while and worked on a hose factory. If you remember the seams and the nylon hose that women wear, we used to put them together on the machine. It was from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till midnight. Many times I would go to sleep right over the machine and I would hit my head on the machine, wake up, and ride the bicycle back to the place where I lived with the family. And one time stopped by the candy store. I wanted to buy some candy, and I didn't speak English much. I just knew the yes, no, thank you, please. And the lady asked me how much of the candy I wanted. I pointed a finger with a finger what candy I wanted, and she said, how much? And I just said, like this. So she filled up the bag of the, like this, and I put paid for it, whatever. I opened my hand with the money, so she took whatever she needed, and I got on the bicycle, and I couldn't wait to get the piece of candy in my mouth. I kept chewing and chewing and chewing. It was a bubble gum. So you learn quickly. The language does make a difference. It does make a difference. I went to see the priest at the church and asked him if he could tell me where the monastery was. He said, why? What do you want to do? I said, I wanted to become a nun. And he said, why do you want to become a nun? I said, because I wanted to worship my Jesus. And well, you've got to do something else. What do you want to do? I said, I want to work with children. He looked at me and he said, you know what? I think you should wait and see what God has in plan for you, which was very interesting. He was a very wise man. I was able to work in New Jersey, and then I ended up working in New York in a Walt Disney studio painting cartoons. You know, I didn't realize how the cartoons are made until I started working, filling out. Every cartoon looks the same, you know. But it's just a little difference, you know, where they flip them together, that's how it makes them move. And pictures, it's amazing. But anyway, I worked there. And then there was a gentleman by name Bill Suddett, who had been in a war during the World War II in Germany, and he had seen these concentration camps. And he had committed himself that someday when he goes back home that he will try to help students like myself to have opportunity to go to school. And so he worked very hard. And so I received a scholarship to go to nursing school in Memphis, Tennessee, and provided by Altruista Club, Women's Altruista Club. I don't know if any of you know any organization such as that here. It's an incredible organization. And there were 50 members of that club. They all were business women. They all had the different businesses, some bakery store, some clothing store, some bridal shop, some china shop, whatever. There were 50 of them, and they provided a scholarship for me to go to Memphis, Tennessee. So I came to Memphis, Tennessee, and I went over there to John Gaston Hospital and got enrolled into work. But I was so bad shape physically, such a terribly malnourished and terribly sick, that they told me after I was there for about several months, they said, really, you need to take a break and just kind of get your health together before you can endure this kind of work. And so I loved the idea of medicine. I loved the idea of nursing. But I ended up, because I needed to make some money, I ended up taking a course in medical technician. So I finished that and went to work for Dr. Wadlington's office. And that's in Memphis where I met my husband. I lived in YWCA home, which is a safe place for the girls to live in Memphis, Tennessee at that time. And there was a pastor that would come and perform the evening service. And he went back and told at his church, Commonwealth Presbyterian Church, the youth department, if they would come and ask me to come and visit and talk to them. And my handsome husband, who was in the Navy at that time, a pilot, in his beautiful white uniform in a dashing Lincoln Continental convertible car, come flying in, you know, and there were two girls, his sister and another girl in the car, so I knew he was already spoken for, so I didn't pay any hopes in that direction. But anyway, as it turned out, God had a plan. Totally different. I had no intentions to chase after this young man, but I think he did start chasing after me. He invited me to come to the youth group, and I declined at first, but then I accepted later, and we started going to church together, and as God has it, we got married, and in November it'll be 62 years since we've been married. Why all of that? Does it really matter? You know, what really matters is the fact that all along the way, my Savior was with me. But let me tell you something. I want you to listen very carefully. We cannot, as a Christians, be complacent to what's happening around us. It is very, very urgent and very important for those that are strong believers not to be silent, and for those that have never yet accepted Jesus as a personal Savior to hurry up and do so, because the dark days are coming. I see the signs in our country, and I see the signs in the world that things are turning in a direction that none of us want, but it will happen. And we need our Lord more than ever, more than ever. Because we have, out of school, taken Him out. We're being taken over with our ideology and things. We're also conditioning our youth today through the television, through the movies, to be indifferent about killing. The games that they play, boys, you know, yeah, they're games, but no, they're not just games. We're conditioning our youth to things of life that are not nice. They're not good. They're not honoring our Lord. And I'm 84. In September, I'll be 85? Am I going to be 85? I'm pretty old, you know that? You know, that's a lot of years. So, you know, I'm not a prophet, but I have lived life. I've seen the signs of how the things happen and how silence allows things to take place that we should not allow. We should be bold enough to speak, and we should be feel that urgency to turn and embrace our marvelous, wonderful God who created this world for us, to honor Him and to protect us and protect everything that He has done. We should love and adore our Creator. As Vicki mentioned earlier, God was so gracious to fulfill my need, which I had a dream of taking care of children. And so God opened the doors to Russia 15 years ago. The doors were wide open, and we went over there to minister to the children and also to bring many of them, especially handicapped children, that would never have had a chance. You know, and then he shut the door. Now look what's happening there. Now just the other day, yesterday, I read article that in Russia they are now going to implement a new laws where they're not going to be able to have a demonstrations on the street. They cannot speak against things. They're going to tighten up over there. The control is getting tighter and tighter. I'm so thankful that we were privileged enough to be able to bless the families here that didn't have children, that wanted to have children, and the children that there did not have families, they couldn't take care of them, they have families here. In fact, I am so, so thrilled to see the Stevens family. They're here tonight, that came all the way from Mesquite, and they're moving to California, and they took time to come here with three of their precious children that we had part in their lives to come here and have their new mom and dad. And also, a precious young lady from Texarkana, too. Just a beautiful, beautiful hacker family. I just am just overjoyed by the fact that God was so gracious to give me the dream to be a part of the children, over 200, that I do claim them all to be my grandchildren. And I really praise Him for that. So I would encourage you, I will so encourage you, if you don't know Jesus Christ, if you have not committed your lives to Him, please do so, because this is the time of urgency for you. Your life would be much richer, much fuller, and you'll be blessed beyond measure, because I stand here as a testimony to that, that without my Jesus, Lord and Savior, I would not be standing here in front of you. And I know He saved my life for the purpose to give the testimony who He is and what He has done for us. He died on the cross for us so that we may live and be forgiven for all that we deserve the death, but He took it upon Himself. And I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so very much for taking time to listen to this old lady.